Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Bobby Rodrigo here. I take liberty with my coffee. November 25th, 2014. Welcome to my show. I'm glad to have you guys with me. Want to get right to it. We got a lot going on, of course. As I mentioned last week, I'm pretty much going to devote the first half hour of the show to recent events relative to the Constitution, relative to events that have happened that the Constitution comes into play in one way or another, as well as all the important issues that are going on that are important to us as a society, and the things that are dividing us, hoping to create a dialogue to where we can come together and create an atmosphere of positive change in our society. That is the goal. We want to make things better. There's so many things wrong in our society right now. So much of it is coming from our government, both in Washington and on the state, local levels, depending upon what the situation is. We're being ignored as citizens. Our votes are not counting because our elected officials are bought, whether we vote for them or not. Laws are being written by lobbyists, and that's been going on for a long time. People are not being held accountable for their actions that have hurt our society in various areas. So I want to get right to it. A couple of things are prominent, of course, and I'll get to those. We all know what they are. I guess we should start with immigration. As everybody is aware, and if anybody isn't, they must have been on a major vacation. Our president went on the air and told the country that he was going to take an executive action in order to start the process of fixing immigration. At least that's how I took it. I mean, he's certainly not going to be able to fix the immigration problem, whatever exactly that is. But he talked to us about what he intended on doing relative to the immigration issues, and he chastised Congress, certainly in his response to their response to his initial speech. He chastised Congress for not doing their job, not creating immigration reform, not doing what the legislative branch of our government is supposed to do under the Constitution in order to fix that problem. Now, of course, the pushback has been, and there's a number of things to talk about relative to the executive orders, but that's not what the show is tonight about, so we're just going to touch it briefly. Of course, one of the pushbacks on this issue is that does the president have the constitutional authority to do this executive order? And a lot of pundits have weighed in, both from inside the legal scholarly to a number of media outlets and so-called experts and a number of our elected officials. The problem I have with the entire discussion is that the executive order hasn't been written yet. I put into the chat room, and I don't know if you guys can see it, so I'll do it again. But I put into the chat room the White House website right to the page where the executive orders are. And like I said, I'll do it again so everybody can see it. But if you go to whitehouse.gov, inside the website, you will see that there is a section that says presidential actions. And if you click on that, underneath presidential actions, you will see executive orders. Now, if you go to executive orders, you will see that the last executive order that he has written was on October 17th. And inside of this area of the White House website, it'll tell you all the executive orders that you've done. So you can certainly take a look at exactly what kind of president he has been relevant to this area of executive orders. Now, the pushback from the other direction, of course, has been, well, executive orders have been going on since, and this president hasn't done as many executive orders as the past presidents, including the one that we just had, Bush 43, Clinton, Bush 41, Ronald Reagan. President with the most executive orders in our history is FDR. Theodore Roosevelt was did a lot of them as well. Excuse me. So we know that there's going to be an argument there, whether or not it's a valid argument. For me, for my purposes, for constitutional analysis, and without the rhetoric, should be, in fact, what exactly he is going to write. What is the executive order going to be? Now, one thing I will tell you is that he did write on November 21st, all this is on, he wrote a presidential memorandum. Memorandum is clear. It's called, there was a couple of them, creating welcoming communities and fully integrating immigrants and refugees. And it goes into a dissertation essentially covering the areas as to why he was saying what he was saying, why he's getting ready to do the executive orders that he intends on implementing. And then the second presidential memorandum from November 21st is called Modernizing and Streamlining the U.S. Immigration Visa System for the 21st Century. Again, he goes into, for example, throughout our nation's history, immigrants have helped the United States build the world's strongest economy. Immigrants represent the majority of our PhDs in math, computer science, and engineering, and over one quarter of all U.S.-based Nobel laureates over the past 50 years were foreign-born. Immigrants are also more than twice as likely as native-born Americans to start a business in the United States. They have started one of every four American small businesses and high-tech startups, and more than 40% of the Fortune 500 companies were founded by immigrants or their children. So he outlines that part of it, and he goes into, but despite the overwhelming contributions of immigrants to our nation's prosperity, our immigration system is broken and has not kept pace with changing times. So he goes into that narrative, and he talks about why he's going to do what he's doing, supporting his speech and what is going to be an executive order. Again, I think it's premature to discuss the authority of the executive order in this area until we see what he actually writes. Because there's no question that the executive has the right to implement certain orders within the executive authority of the Constitution. Now, they certainly don't have the right to overstep the separation of powers, without question. And he may do that, and I may come back and say, well, you know, I don't think the president is writing an executive order that is constitutional. Absolutely. There's a number of things that are going on in the last 20 years that are not constitutional in that regard, executive order and congressional delegations that have gone on. But as far as the immigration process is concerned, we know that it's broken. We know that whatever is done has to be done quickly in some way, shape, or form. It doesn't really matter to this point what it is. I will say this. In the United States of America, if you are on this soil or in an area that is technically the United States of America, the Constitution is relevant to you. The Constitution is not only for citizens. The Constitution is relevant for anybody that is processed. So the immigration laws are in place. The deportation laws are laws. They are subject to our constitutional protections in order to be prosecuted. When they break our laws, it is alleged that they have broken our laws. They are accused of it. They are arrested for it. They are subject to the process. And the immigration process is what is going on. And considering the influx of the amount of immigrants, it is completely out of balance. Excuse me for that. So, what do we do? Well, the president has offered a scenario that gives us a possible fix. I'm not sure if I agree with what he intends, but we'll see. We'll see. He has to write it. He has to put it out so we can sit there and look at it and see what's going on. So please do not fall into the rhetoric trap, pro or con, until he actually writes the rhetoric. This will allow us to see exactly what he intends to do and whether or not Congress and their complaints or support are in fact valid. And of course, the bigger issue that we have going on in our society right now is the situation in Ferguson. One of the things I wanted to share with you guys this evening was a letter that was written to the Missouri National Guard that I thought was real important. And this was written when the decision came out. It's called The Veterans Appeal to National Guard. Stand with Ferguson Protesters, Not the Police. I'll say that again. Stand with Ferguson Protesters, Not the Police. It says, to our brothers and sisters in the Missouri National Guard, we are writing to you as active duty U.S. service members and veterans, most of us having served in the Iraq War. You have a choice you can make right now. The whole world is watching the Ferguson police with disgust. They killed an unarmed college-bound black youth in broad daylight and subsequently responded to peaceful, constitutionally protected protests with extreme violence and repression. And I want to address that paragraph at length here. It says, the whole world is watching the Ferguson police with disgust. Now, I can tell you that I was working very closely with some people who were there in Ferguson during the first set of protests that went on right after the killing of Brown. And I was furious with the way the police were dealing with the protesters, and they were violent and repressive. They handled it horribly. And there was, it is well documented, well video documented, with the things that they did. And of course, we all remember, or at least I hope we do, hope everybody does, you know, how the police was fumbling through it, and how the governor got involved and sent the National Guard, and how the state police came in and took over before that happened. It, a number of aspects of that was, it was obvious that the situation was elevated from a violent stance from the standpoint of the police more so than it should have been. Now, the killing of an unarmed college-bound black youth in broad daylight and subsequent is, I have a problem with that part of this because I have never addressed on purpose the incident between Wilson and Brown because I wanted to let the process go for it. I wasn't there. I didn't see it. I don't know the evidence. I didn't talk to the witnesses. I did read the autopsy report when it came out, of course. I followed all of that. Tried to filter out the ridiculous amount of rhetoric that went around those things and the different interpretations about it. And the only important thing mattered was all of the evidence and all the witnesses were being put before the grand jury by the prosecutor. So, as somebody who believes in the Constitution, I have to believe in the process, as long as it's not corrupted, otherwise I'm a hypocrite. So moving on, countless constitutional and human rights violations by these police have been documented over the course of the Ferguson protest. That's true. From attacking and threatening journalists, true, to using tear gas against peaceful protesters, true, including children, true. Now, Governor Nixon has again activated the National Guard to support law enforcement. But you don't have to follow their orders. You can stand with protesters instead. Our true duty, when we signed up, we swore an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States. The police in Ferguson are violating that Constitution, true. The First Amendment guarantees the right to free speech, freedom of assembly, and freedom of the press, true. What is wrong with that statement is that the First Amendment protects those rights. We have those rights as natural-born citizens. The Constitution even says that. Those are protected. The Constitution of Missouri even goes further than the federal constitution about our natural rights, by the way. The Constitution of Missouri is 8 times longer than the federal constitution, I learned recently. I decided to read it, which I had to do it through the research, but gosh, let me tell you. They dotted a lot of I's and crossed a lot of T's. These laws, as we are taught our entire lives, are most cherished constitutional rights, the whole basis for the freedom we are told makes us the greatest country on earth. It is undeniable that the Ferguson police has used extreme violence against peaceful protesters, suppressing the right of the people to free speech and the freedom to assemble. They have attacked crowds with children in them with rubber bullets, sound cannons, and tear gas, all true. People have been mass arrested for simply being at the protest, also true. Freedom of the press has also been severely infringed upon by Ferguson police. Journalists have been arrested, true. Photo evidence shows Riot police firing tear gas directly at reporters and tearing down their camera equipment, also true. Ferguson police have been caught on video threatening journalists with violence if they don't leave and declaring that they are not allowed in the protest area, also true. With such important and dramatic events unfolding, the right of the people of the United States to have the truth covered by the press is essential to any so-called democratic society. People have the right to protest. If we were truly honoring our oath, we would be in Ferguson to protect the protesters against the repression of their rights by the police. We don't just have a legal obligation, but a moral one. Clearly, we would be within our legal rights to refuse to help the Ferguson police unconstitutionally suppress these protests. But beyond the constitutional case, we have a moral obligation to refuse to participate. The Ferguson police are treating this like a war, and we know that not all wars are just. These protests have done something very important in our society. They have raised the deep issues we face of inequality, poverty, racism, and police misconduct onto a national stage. It has turned public consciousness to these real problems that plague our society. If you really want to be part of suppressing civilians, raising all these important issues on the national stage. So this particular letter that I'm reading you is signed by post 9/11 veterans. All their names are here. The majority of them are, in fact, present day members of our military. All branches are represented. Then there is pre 9/11, that post 9/11 veterans, and the majority of them are still in. A number of are out from. And but the most of them served in the Iraq War, like the beginning of the letter said. And then you have pre-9/11 veterans, and all of them are listed here. They sign their names to it. Now, this is, to me, a very, very important document for a lot of reasons. Number one, the very fact that there is a group of people in our military writing this letter and saying that they're taking the, and I took the oath. I'm a Navy vet. I served under St. Reagan. And actually, it was Ronnie that made me an activist, all the things I saw when I was under his leadership. And I essentially said that this is what you do when you give an oath, that you're going to defend the Constitution in our country with our lives. We forfeit our lives. So we are supposed to take that very seriously. I find it, when I was in the service, I found that a lot of people in there pretty much understood what they had done. There was a percentage, of course, that didn't quite see it as deeply. They didn't realize that their life was just basically given to the issue, and any time could be forfeit. But these people certainly do, because they're saying it, and they signed the letter, and they're telling the National Guard in the state of Missouri not to follow orders. That's a major deal. Something like that, I would bet, has never happened before to this degree. So after watching the way the protests went the first time, they did not want their fellow service members to stand there and do what it was that they were being asked to do. And of course, things like tear gas and rubber bullets are you know, the tear gas thing is interesting because we, of course, are not, we don't believe that tear gas is a proper item to be used in warfare, and yet we'll use it on the street of our own society to break up a crowd. I did find that interesting. That was something that came out a lot last time around. But again, as I said, that is a pretty powerful issue. The second thing on this, I feel, is, you know, again, you have to respect the process. You cannot assume the corruption. It's hard not to sometimes, of course. Our society screams of it. I've actually had some discussions recently in the Coffee Party universe that has surprised me. People are accepting what the government is telling us so easily when we have so much evidence that they don't tell us what the truth so many different times in our lives. So I found this letter interesting in that while they're telling the National Guard not to honor their orders and to stand with the people, which is, again, very powerful, you have to respect the process. So it creates a paradox. But again, the oath does mean something. So there's a very, very powerful organization out there called the Oath Keepers. Respect them immensely. I interact with them a lot. For me, it doesn't matter who you are. It matters what you stand for. It matters how you behave. It matters how you treat other people in our society. It matters what you do. So there's plenty of people in any organization that I'm going to debate with on any particular issue or stance, especially when it comes to how you are supporting a behavior against people or how you are behaving against people on the basis of class or stereotyping. But overall, the message of an organization like that is also very powerful. And the same thing with the sheriff's organization that are now becoming prominent. One of the things the division has caused to the positive is people are starting to understand what duties are relative to the Constitution. Sheriffs and the military in particular. That's why this letter was written. Whether the reasons are good or bad that made them go there, the fact that they're there, there can be nothing wrong with his rights, and he's not going to let, you know, another person. It's the old story. If there are six cops standing there watching another cop doing bad things, then there's no good cop there. So all these organizations do not support bad cops. They support the Constitution, and they support calling people out. Somebody who I call a friend here in Georgia, Derek Grayson, who his mantra is 100% of the Constitution, 100% of the time. What he wants to do as a member of the upper chamber, if he in fact wins the next election, is what he wants to do is he wants to name names and call people out. It doesn't matter who it is. He doesn't care if it's a Republican or Democrat. Regardless, if he wins, he'll be a Republican. And he wants to call him out. He does it now. You know, if people are going to not follow the Constitution that they took the oath for, they should be called out. I completely agree with that, and I think we should do way more of that, as much as possible. So those are two things that I wanted to discuss. You have to discuss these things right now. Otherwise, I might as well not do a radio show about current events and subject matter that's necessary for our society. I wanted to give you a little background on my guest tonight. She'll be calling in here in a little while. Her name is Catherine Bernard. She's an attorney here in Georgia. I had the pleasure of meeting her earlier this year. I had invited her to speak at the Panda Take Back Tour. I know you guys have heard me mention that before. The People Against the NDA put on a coalition event, concert series across the country. And Atlanta was one of those that we had. And we had artists and speakers discussing various parts of our society. And Catherine spoke because she is an expert on jury nullification and the jury system. So I was on the radio last week, actually, with Janine Loudon, Lunch with Loudon. We were talking to Dan Johnson from Solutions Institute, a young man who I respect immensely, has a great knowledge of liberty and the Constitution. His fight against the indefinite detention of the NDA has been fantastic. And he mentioned during our conversations, we were talking about the legal process, that he wanted to make sure that he knew what the grand jury system was, and I was taken aback by that. So I've seen some comments today about the jury being 9 white, black, and the unanimous decision. It takes 9 people to know Bill, which is not accurate at all. I have no idea what the makeup of the grand jury was. If that information is common knowledge or out there, it's actually a violation of the state of Missouri Constitution. The grand jury deliberation, the grand jury identity, and any discussion by the members of the grand jury is completely forbidden by law. Always has been. So, of course, the prosecutor got up there and embellished us with what he thought were the reasoning behind it, and he immediately released all the evidence that he put in front of the grand jury, which certainly helps his embellishment as far as, well, this is why this happened and this is why they were thinking that. But in actuality, we don't know what the grand jury was thinking, and neither does he, because they can't talk about it, even to him. They get to see the evidence. They get to ask questions. They get to deliberate, and they get to come out with a decision. Nine people, it takes nine people to indict, which means it takes four to no bill. I don't know what the makeup of the court was. I suppose he would have had to have been the one to say it, I suppose. I don't think the court released such information like that. But maybe, who knows, with the leaks that we have in our society, it's possible. But the important thing about the grand jury process is the process. So I invited Catherine Bernard to come onto the show in this area and the whole issue of probable cause, being an attorney, a practicing attorney. She's also an activist. She's also an advocate for consciousness of government. And she just told me earlier today that she's involved in another project in order to help our society here in Georgia that I'll let her tell you about when she calls in. But that's a little bit about Catherine. And treat her well. Give her a coffee party welcome. If you want to call in and ask any questions, feel free to do so. I'm going to let her talk at length about the grand jury process, et cetera. In the meantime, I want to take care of some business for us by waiting for her to get here. As you know, Coffee Party Radio has a number of shows. On Thursday at noon Pacific and 3 Eastern Time, we have Lunch with Loudon, with Janine Loudon and Devlyn Molyneux. Excellent ladies, excellent show, very informative, any subject that they discuss very well. Information, they do a lot of prep on their shows. They put out a lot of information prior to their shows so people can interact with the information and see what's going on, get into the discussion with them. They do great work, and of course, they're on the board of the Coffee Party. On Saturday, Egberto Willis, Politics Done Right, 1 o'clock Eastern Time. I know I have interacted with Egberto and consider him a friend. We have known each other now for 3 years plus. I can tell you that he is trying his best to make our society a better place. His information is accurate. He does his homework. He spends a lot of time working on his subject matters and his show, and he always offers an opportunity for everybody to be heard. So make sure and tune in to the Coffee Party shows, Politics Done Right, and Lunch with Loudon. While we're waiting for Catherine to come in, anybody wants to talk about anything, feel free to call 646-929-2495, 646-929-2495. I want to discuss something real quick. One of the areas that's been a concern in our society is militarization. And we heard during the first protest situation in Ferguson, all of these different politicians in Washington and across the state area and local about the militarization of our police, about the program at the Pentagon, how to stop, how so many elected officials jumped on board, say, we got to stop this, we're going to stop this, it's wrong, we're going to take a look, we got time to have a hearing, all of those things. So we just had the midterm election, of course. They got as much out of that as they could at that time. So there was an article that was put out today that says Washington bails on demilitarization after Ferguson. Lawmakers vowed changes to the Pentagon program that delivered military-grade equipment to local police after thousands of cops climbing out of armored vehicles, military-grade weapons filtered out of Ferguson. All true. But months later, the chaotic 1033 program, which sends surplus military gear built for combat to local police forces with little oversight, no oversight, let's be real, no oversight at all, hasn't changed at all. The 113th Congress will end without some substantive changes to the program. The White House hasn't announced the results of the policy review. The flow of billions in technology designed for the battlefield to local police forces will go on unabated. The fear is that this is some kind of moment that passed. Just another example of temporary interest in a crisis, and inevitably things go back to normal. said Radley Balco, the prominent expert on police militarization and author of the most cited book on this topic. I had the pleasure of meeting Radley back in April of this past year at the Students for Liberty national event in Washington, D.C. There were so many good people there. Like I know I've mentioned it before. The Rise of the Warrior Cop is the name of the book that Radley Balco wrote. He works for the Washington Post now. I believe he was working for the Huffington Post when he wrote the book. I don't remember the timetable, but he works for the Washington Post now. Looking at the history on this issue tends to make one cynical. Balco knows firsthand how serious the post-Ferguson militarization conversation was in Washington. Around the time, Senator Rand Paul, of course, my nickname for Rand Paul is Trick Liberty, so Senator Trick Liberty, published his August op-ed calling for re-examination of programs that send military equipment to local police forces, making the Kentucky Republican the most prominent politician on demilitarization in the country. That is very true. He did do that. A member of Paul's staff reached out to Balco to discuss his work on militarization. They talked about the 1033 program. The Pentagon program is free to the local police force and transfers billions in property to local police, most of it non-lethal gear like office furniture. The program also offers armored vehicles and military weaponry. What it's worth, Balco doesn't think 1030 program aimed at sending military gear at local police. That is true. A Department of Homeland Security grant program that helps police forces pay for brand new military gear is most worrisome. And that is a big sometime back in February of 2002. The town had two murders since 1999, according to a report by Balco for the Huffington Post, and he did work for them back then. And had just accepted $285,000 grant from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to purchase a Bearcat, an 8-ton armored personnel vehicle made by Lenko Industries. So, what are we doing here? Tell me why the local police, if you can, anybody, would need an 8-ton. And if you think in the light of, well, the crime is high, well, what would a town in New Hampshire with two murders in 13 years need with an 8-ton tank in their arsenal that they get to buy for free from the manufacturer? I don't understand that at all. Somebody has to tell me why the police need to buy armored tanks. Somebody has to tell me intelligently. For example, in the House, a Georgia Democrat had been trying to build support for changes to 1033 since December 10th of 2013 when he walked behind a hulking military vehicle with police markings during a Christmas parade in a small town outside of Atlanta. This is Hank Johnson, who is a problem for other reasons. Asked his staff to find out where the vehicle came from and started to grow concerned when he learned about how the 1030 worked, etc. And there has been nothing done about the militarization of the police, nor the grant program for the Department of Security. So keep that in mind, everybody. And I see that Catherine is called in. And Catherine, I have introduced you to our audience already. So I'm going to put you live on the air and say hello and thank you for joining.
Hi, Bobby. Thanks so much for having me.
Certainly. I was telling everybody a little bit about your background. I wanted you to chime in on that and let everybody know what you do and what your areas of expertise are.
Well, I am a lawyer. I am a lawyer who thinks that lawyers are ruining this country, but that's what I am. I was a public defender for 4 years in rural Georgia in Dublin, and now I do private criminal defense and some public work as well. I do spend a lot of time on activism and politics because what I'm seeing in the courtroom is just so disturbing and so far away from what almost any American wants to reflect their values that I really think we've got a responsibility to tell everyone about what's going on in the justice system. And so that's what I try to do through activism, politics, and still in front of juries in the courtroom.
Yeah, no doubt. I've seen, we have interacted online and we met back at the Panda Take Back Tour. I was getting everybody's background on that. And one of the areas that we talked about is jury nullification, of course. And I've been noticing, before we get into the main topic, I've been noticing that you've been dealing city council, trying to anyway, to make them act and to make them behave properly. And I know that you're out there swinging. I did mention to everybody that you spoke to a new project that you're doing, but I didn't want to get into it. I wanted to tell about it, but I wanted to make sure I had a chance to tell everybody what you're doing with the services that you mentioned to me.
Well, absolutely. I have been working on a lot of stuff with city council. I live in Brookhaven, which is the newest city in Georgia and also basically a part of Atlanta. And 2 years ago, they were able to convince a small majority of voters during a summer election that they could somehow get smaller government by voting to create a new layer of government. I know. But it worked, and so we're a city. And, of course, our new city government has wasted no time using as much taxpayer money as possible to hire more staff, pad their pockets, work on development projects that benefit wealthy cronies at the expense of residents of the area. Most recently, we dealt with the Redevelopment Powers Law referendum, which I know just the word referendum is boring, but what this law would have done is expanded eminent domain and given the city the power to put us into debt without even asking us first through a vote. And what's scary is this law that was put on the books in Georgia in the 80s is actually already the law all around cities and counties in Georgia. This was the first time a city had rejected it. So, you know, that does tie into a lot of the issues that we're talking about tonight, because anything that gives local government more control is unfortunately going to give police more control as well. And in fact, our police chief here has already talked about trying to make drug-free zones on Buford Highway, which would not be allowed to be if they had ever had a drug conviction. So talk about your constitutional implications there.
Yeah, Georgia has some funny stuff that actually I know you're aware of. We had candidates that ran, had an incident in the past with the loitering law was set up in this state and the way it was worded, and all he wanted to do was fix the wording of it, make it constitutional, and it backfired on him because of rhetoric and politics. And Georgia has a lot of funny things going on, and I know you know that, and it just goes along with, I don't know, what are we in the twilight? I don't know.
Well, I wish I could say it was just Georgia, but it's not. You know, we're facing these problems all over the country. And I think Georgia actually has some pretty cool things working for us in that we could possibly be an example to others about how to bring people together regardless of party label for constitutional values. You know, I think this case in Ferguson is a classic example of where conservatives, liberals, everybody who does not identify with the party label, which is, of course, the majority, you know, everybody should be concerned right about these violations of our civil rights and civil liberties.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. The Ferguson, especially the first round of protests, the police action from the protests was so egregious. And they were caught. And they were caught so obviously. You know, you have to... One thing that the internet has done and our technology has done now, you can take a picture with anything, you can take a video with anything, really did show what was going on. If anybody paid attention to Ferguson in any way, shape, or form, they saw so much bad, unconstitutional behavior by the state of Missouri, the local police, et cetera, that we have probably never really seen like that ever in our lives, not day in and day out, I'd have to say. The technology really helped there.
Well, a lot of people are comparing this to the riots in 1968 after Martin Luther King was assassinated, or some of the riots in the 70s in L.A. So we have seen something like this, but I think you're absolutely right that this is not something that we are used to. It's still shocking to a lot of people. And that's an advantage for those of us who are trying to draw attention to the failures of the system, is we have a window where people are looking at the situation and recognizing something's not right. So hopefully we can be there to fill in some of the gaps with, yes, this is what we've been telling you about, you know, the police state getting too big and government not following the Constitution.
Yes, indeed. I wanted to spend some of the time on the show with you discussing probable cause and the jury process. Of course, we have the decision. And I found it interesting, first of all, I was talking about it before you came on, that there's been some information put out that the grand jury was 9 white, 3 black, and the decision was unanimous. I found that interesting because the only person that could have talked about that was the prosecutor, because we know that deliberations, who they are, and their ability to talk about it is more secret than allowed to. So when he embellished and told us all about what was going on, and he immediately released all the files, I thought that we should talk about exactly what it was that the grand jury was doing, so people can understand it really well, because so many people think this was a trial. So many people, they don't know what it is. It's just the large group of people that don't really understand what just happened. And I wanted you to get into the probable cause aspect of what happened, please.
There are a lot of folks who, they hear about juries, and thank you very much for mentioning my work with jury nullification. That's another big priority as we're trying to seek justice. But it's true, a lot of folks don't understand the difference between a grand jury and a trial jury, or also known as a traverse jury. And the difference, it does slightly differ from state to state, but in general, a grand jury is a very preliminary stage. They're the ones determining if there's enough probable cause for the case to go forward, for there to be a formal indictment. And, you know, some states do it differently in terms of whether or not the prosecutor can bring formal charges without an indictment. But here in Georgia, no one can be charged with a felony unless their case has been presented to a grand jury and the grand jury has found a true bill, or that there was probable cause, a reasonable probability to suspect that this person has committed a crime. That's a much lower bar than beyond a reasonable doubt or clear and convincing evidence.
Yes, indeed. I know that the probable cause aspect of it, my own education is essentially broken down into two parts. Number one is that there was, in fact, a crime, the probability that there was a crime. And number two is that it is likely or probable that the person who is being charged with is the one who did it. So, I mean, which is essentially what you described, and that is all the burden that has to go on. So tell us how they do it.
Well, again, it differs a little bit state by state, but in general, it is a process that is driven by the district attorney. They are the ones that present the evidence to the grand jury, and the grand jury is selected from the same group of people that make up the regular jury pool, active voters, although in most states, they are required to be individuals of especially high moral and honorable capacity, you know, whatever that is supposed to mean. What it means in practice is that members of a grand jury tend to be even more from the same classes of people who would be friends with the judge, friends with the district attorney, you know, very frequent voters. That's the group of people that's making up the grand jury. And so what happens is the grand jury is impaneled or brought together, and at that point, the district attorney presenting evidence to them. And there's a lot of latitude for the district attorney in how to present this evidence. Sometimes they'll choose to bring in witnesses. Usually it's the witness would be an officer, a law enforcement officer who participated in the arrest. That's your standard situation, is just one law enforcement officer testifies to the grand jury, I saw such and such on such and such date committing this crime. And that's generally enough to get an indictment. Sometimes there will be additional people brought in. Perhaps if there's a non-law enforcement victim, that person might be brought in. Though in my experience, it's fairly rare for an actual victim to be brought before a grand jury, both because of it can be a traumatic experience and because it can make the case harder to prove for the district attorney. But in any case, the grand jury then has the option of returning either a true bill or a no bill. And a true bill means that there was enough evidence to go forward. A no bill means that it can't go forward. And in Georgia, if a case is no billed twice, that is, it's presented to two different grand juries and neither one of them returns an indictment, the case is barred from ever being presented again. It's kind of like double jeopardy. So the grand jury can be impaneled for a long period of time. They can consider a lot, if there's one particular case that the district attorney wants to focus on, like the Michael Brown case in Ferguson, they can remain impaneled for several weeks. We had a situation like that here in Georgia in Habersham County with the child who was blown up by the flash grenade that was thrown into his crib. That was also a very lengthy grand jury process. And I do want to emphasize that these grand jurors, you know, they take their responsibility very seriously, and they really are trying to do the best thing for their community. But what we have to remember is that the prosecutor shapes the entire process. A lot of us have heard that old saying about how a prosecutor could indict a ham sandwich, and it really is true. Because the prosecutor has exclusive control over the proceedings, the defendant is not allowed to be present. The defendant's attorney is not allowed to be present. And in fact, in Georgia, the proceedings are secret. They are not in Missouri, so the defendant will never get access to what is said. In practice, that means the prosecutor can shape things exactly the way he or she wants. So if the prosecutor wants an indictment, they'll get an indictment. If they want the case to be rejected by the grand jury, it's very easy to shape the case in a way for that to make sense.
And of course, if nobody's watching, you really can't see how, in fact, they are doing one or the other. I found it interesting you mentioned the Missouri not being secret. What did you mean by that? I was on the impression that it was in the regard that the information that's coming out now is basically just the prosecutor saying what he presented. Am I misunderstanding that?
I believe that there have been transcripts of actual testimony released, and that's what I've been
correct.
Looking at today. And
yeah,
I've actually been in court. So there have been some formal releases, and I don't know if that was a choice of the prosecutor, if the prosecutor could have chosen to keep it secret. I do know in Georgia it is secret. The prosecutor does not release grand jury testimony.
My understanding of the background of that is that the court does have to release the records. You do have to get permission from the court. Well, what I found interesting is that at least the reports, I mean, obviously I'm not there or calling the court, but the reports were out of the courthouse. I was paying attention that they had not been asked yet. This is what the court was telling. And of course, we all know that there's chambers and such. But my understanding is that the court does, in fact, have to agree to have them released upon request. And there has to be, and there's actually a standard from what I read. I haven't confirmed it statutorily. Again, I'm just reading reports. But my understanding is that there has to be a standard has to be met in order for the documents to be released. One of the standards is for the better of society, et cetera. So perhaps that is true, and perhaps he did get permission. It really, I mean, as soon as he spoke to the audience, the stuff came out. It was 2 seconds. All the information was out there. So I wonder, as you mentioned, whether or not he has to get permission or not, for sure. Were you surprised by that?
I was a little bit surprised, but I know in Habersham they ended up releasing the grand jury's opinion, their final opinion, which usually the grand jury does not render anything that detailed. So I think there is a consciousness on the part of the justice system that people are interested, people want to know what's going on, so they do want to appear to be open. Now, I did use the word appear to be open because when you mention standards like it has to be in the best interest of society, you know, the law is rife with that kind of a standard. And all it means in practice is whatever the judge wants to do.
Absolutely. Totally discretionary. Absolutely. It's amazing how that works. It's almost like they don't want to be cornered with actual mandated language. And you see that all the time. I mean, you work in a cesspool of discretionary stuff. As you know,
that's a very good way of putting it. Very good way of putting it, because it is very frustrating. You know, I came from a debate in political science and philosophy background where I really expected, you know, both sides to be considered and for us to adhere to the letter of the Constitution and to give people the presumption of innocence. But in practice, that's just not happening in our justice system, and it's not because of a lot of malicious intent on the part of judges or prosecutors. It's just been the slow, inexorable creep of bureaucracy and the growth of government. You know, the bigger government gets, the more things are against the law, the more even an honest prosecutor and judge can say, well, he did violate the law. I guess I'd better, you know, make sure that he gets convicted. And that's the way they look at it.
The books are getting expanded. There's no question about that. The laws that are on even laws that shouldn't be on the books that were written a long time ago still remain. As you mentioned, that there's a lot that they just keep making laws that are and then we know when they write things like the Patriot Act and they actually say, well, we don't need probable cause anymore to take your phone records or surveil you or anything like that. They literally put it in the language. It's like, well, who cares about the Constitution? We'll just void it. Yeah, it is a very frustrating thing to see. Even if you're not someone who we grew up on this. You know, I grew up on learning the Bill of Rights. You know, I mentioned earlier when I took the oath to serve our country, I knew what I was doing. My life was being forfeited, but I knew why. I knew what the Constitution said. We were taught that, and we have come to the point where, regardless of whether you want government to be big, small, or whatever, how can you reconcile the disregard that is done so easily? I mean, they just toss it away like nothing, and we just sit there and let it. It blows my mind.
It really does, and that's it has gotten so bad though that's really the silver lining to me, is that people are starting to set aside, you know, the preconceived notions, because I think they're recognizing that's keeping us from understanding our neighbors. It's to me, the case of Michael Brown is not a classic police brutality case. You know, there's too many questions about what actually happened. Maybe Darren Wilson was justified. Frankly, I have some questions based on the inconsistencies in his testimony, but, you know, maybe he was justified. There are plenty of cases out there where there's absolutely no argument for justification whatsoever. And not to be too conspiratorial and tinfoil hat, but I do think that there are people who benefit from diverting public attention to these unclear cases, because they know that they are stirring up a very real and authentic anger at the criminal justice system and the injustice that it wreaks. That anger is real. These protesters in Ferguson, they really are being mistreated. But unfortunately, their anger is being channeled into something that makes them almost look ridiculous to a lot of people. And it allows people from the other side to say, oh, look at those idiots. Look at them supporting a thug. Well, they're not supporting a thug. They are angry at a very broken justice system. And it's unfortunate that our media and people like Al Sharpton have directed that anger into the wrong place.
Ain't that the truth? A man with no credibility. You know, you mentioned something, and it rang a big bell in my head. We think a lot alike, and I have also been concerned about this particular limelight, this particular case, rather, being a limelight like you, considering the other cases that are out there that are clear-cut abuses of force. We just had one last week with the guy in the stairway walking down the stairs with no gun. He wasn't being looked at. He just got shot, you know. And then we had another one right around the time of this, where the guy was at the Walmart. Somebody called the police because he had a toy gun, and they came in and shot him, you know. And these instances, there are no even the case you mentioned in Haversham, which I'm involved with, I know you're involved with here locally. And for people who don't know, what had happened was that there was a raid on a house. It was a SWAT raid on a house. And they threw in a grenade, and a child was disfigured. It got national prominence. Even that case had some gray area as to putting those aside, as egregious as those were. You know, Brown was an unarmed man. I have a problem with unarmed people get killed. But again, the process, if putting aside any possibility of corruption, the process was the grand jury came back and no bill. They saw the evidence. Wilson testified for 4 hours. I did see inconsistencies as well. But again, you know, the grand jury did their job, and unless any evidence otherwise, you assume that they did it ethically. But there were other cases where it's black and white. I read today, Catherine, I don't know if you've seen this yet, but Salt Lake City has killed more people than the gangs or any other violence. Salt Lake City police have killed more people than any other aspect of society has, gangs or anything else. It's since 19. So I have to go back and get the story, but it's over like a 5-year period. So it would be 19. I think it was 2009. Yes, 2009 to 2012, when the records were available, the Salt Lake City police killed more people than any other aspect of society did. I thought that was amazing.
It's shocking. I saw that as well. And, you know, Americans are 8 times more likely to be killed by a police officer than they are by a terrorist. And that's a scary figure. You know, this isn't something that people should push off as something that happens to other people. This happens to men like David Hooks, you know, in East Dublin, business owner and grandfather.
Tell everybody about them. That's something that you're working on as well that we have here. Tell everybody about David Hooks.
Absolutely. David Hooks was an East Dublin business owner and grandfather whose home was burglarized in September. So he reported it to the sheriff's office, as anyone else would. They quickly found the person who was responsible. He ran from his mother's house, and it turns out he was a confidential informant. This thief, this burglar, was already working for the sheriff's department. So he got special treatment. And he told them, well, this guy that I robbed, he had some methamphetamine. Based on nothing more than that, the word of an admitted thief, the sheriff's office got a search warrant and did a SWAT raid on Mr. Hooks' home at 11 o'clock the next night on a man that had just been burglarized. His wife saw people in camo and vehicles approaching at a high rate of speed with their lights off. She told her husband there were people there, that maybe the burglars were back. He went to the door with a shotgun, never even raised it, and they blew him away in his front hall. It was really just, I think it may be one of the strongest cases so far, because all he did was report a burglary. That's all he did.
That's it. And they caught the guy that did it.
But it turns out that he was already working for the sheriff's office. And it reminds me of just how often these drug task forces use as confidential informants people who have committed real crimes. You know, thieves, burglars, we'll let you out of jail if you bring us somebody who's got some Xanax. By the way, no contraband was found in David Hooks' house. Not that it would have excused his murder if it had. But I will, if I can make one brief plug, we are having another rally for David Hooks in Dublin, Georgia, at the Lawrence County Courthouse on December 13th. That's at 2 o'clock.
Yes.
And if anybody wants any email...
Fantastic. If you weren't going to do it, I was. I actually
Wonderful.
Missed the last one myself, but oh, I intend on being there as well. I'll try and cover it for the radio show.
Fantastic.
You know, Citizen Journalist. Yeah, we need to shine the light. You know, there's 500,000 people on the Coffee Party USA Facebook page. You know, so one of the reasons why I do this, we have an opportunity to be heard on these issues. And, you know, folks, we're not making this up. This is what's going on in our society. Take a look and find out. All the information is out there. You know, the David Hooks has been reported. Don't Google it. Really a lawyer? She really knows what she's talking about.
We're
not making this up, everybody. Pay attention to what's going on, without a doubt. So tell me, Catherine, what was your initial reaction to the grand jury decision?
I was not surprised. I did think it was a little egregious of them to release it at 7 o'clock at night. I mean, what were they thinking there, other than that they were trying to get people riled up? But I wasn't surprised. Very often, officers are not indicted. In Georgia, in Atlanta, we have a prosecutor who actually hires special experts to come in and defend officers at the grand jury stage. So it was not surprising to me that Darren Wilson was not indicted. and unfortunately that people who were legitimately angry over the system as a whole would choose to unleash their anger at this particular target.
You know, they had initially said that they were going to announce the verdict. They actually were trying to do it. They thought it would be easier, you know, the schools would be open, all of that. And they were going to try and do it on Sunday morning, I think they said, something like that. And so all of that was strategically done. How they wind up on, you know, at 7 o'clock at night, I'm with you on that. I don't get that. Maybe they need more time to mobilize or something. I don't know. I just didn't get that at all. Why not do it in the morning? You know, when everybody's waiting around to hear what's going on. I don't get that. I know that you had mentioned, I've been going over the testimony. I don't know. You know, I don't know what I'm going to see by doing that. You know, we weren't in the room. We can't assess the credibility of any witnesses. They're sitting at, and I know you were the attorney. I think that it is better to focus on situations that are black and white. David Hook's situation is black and white. God only knows what's going to happen considering where we are, but that's a black and white situation. I know the Haberstam situation was really bad. The results of it, I was a little surprised, but I remember the did you go to the first protest where they had the Haberstam? There was a bunch of local citizens that were there.
I did, the one in June, yes, where there actually was a counter-protest. It was fascinating.
Yes. Yeah, and I wasn't there, but of course, you know, you and I have a number that we interact with, and I know there was a number of them there. I know Sharon Revert was there, who's on this show last week, actually, and I believe Ted was there, Ted Metz, among others. But anyway, I had heard that from the reports, actually live that day, some of the things that the counter-protesters were saying, and it was comical, because there was a coalition of people that were there protesting what had happened to that baby. It wasn't from, like you mentioned when you first came on, it was liberals, conservatives, different party people, and different politics, and yet rhetoric was that, well, everybody's lumped up into supporting criminals because they have, you know, drugs. And it was amazing to me. I didn't know you were such a criminal, Kathy.
It really was disturbing. It really was, because, you know, I spent a lot of time talking to the counter protesters. It turns out one of them was actually one of my Facebook friends that we hadn't met in person yet. He was an ex-law enforcement officer himself. We had a great chat, you know, really, really had a good discussion. And a lot of them were not aware that there had been no drugs found in the house. That was something that had been sort of spread around, but was not true. So they were open, the ones I spoke to were open to getting new information, and they were also, there was a pride element, and we can't ignore that as we make these constitutional legal arguments. We can't ignore the fact that, you know, we're talking about people's brothers and uncles and aunts who are these law enforcement officers who, you know, 99% of them are really good people. But
that's right.
We need to
emphasize that too, because in all these things that are going on, and as important as they are, to emphasize that you and I both know a great number of people that are, and that needs to be emphasized whenever we're talking about this stuff. We can't forget the other side.
We absolutely have to remember that, and that's what makes the current system so scary to me. You know, monsters, sadists, you know, those are scary, but we can deal with them. You know, we identify them and get rid of them. What's much scarier is when we have a system in place where good people can do evil things and feel like they're just doing their job. And that's when we really have to worry about the fabric of civilization. And unfortunately, based on what I've read about Darren Wilson, that seems to be the case. He really believed that he was doing the right thing. And that is something we've got to take into account as we try to make these cultural shifts and educate people about what's actually going on.
Yeah, no doubt. And I also emphasize that we have to stop listening to our media. I wanted to have you do a little input on that as well, if you have some more time. I have a big, one of the things I discuss as much as anything is the disinformation rhetoric, literally the lying that goes on by our mainstream media, as well as the lack of journalism that we have in our society right now. I want you to comment on that.
Well, it really is a shame, and I think a lot of it is just sort of a very natural human reaction to cast the facts in the way that makes you and your organization look best. But it is true that we have media who will very credulously report police officers' claims and department claims. But I think there has been a little bit of a shift. You know, media is always going to go for the most polarizing narrative because they want eyeballs. You know, that's what's going to drive people to their content. So they want to whip up that polarization. But I think that, you know, especially with committed citizen journalists, thoughtful people writing letters to the editor, really trying to push our news outlets in the right direction, I think we've got an opportunity to possibly shift that and show that people really are interested in reading, you know, a truthful analysis of the David Hook situation. I mean, then you get into the fact that these legal issues can be difficult to understand even for lawyers who spend all their time studying it. So digesting it and presenting it in a way that will catch people's attention with a headline can be a real challenge.
No doubt, no doubt, and always has been. You know, my issue with the media too has been the duplicity that it has. Like you mentioned, that they always do the police narrative. They do it on pretty much every government level. And, you know, of course, they only want to talk about candidates, politicians, other people. It's a shame, you know. And we have majority of our media owned by six corporations. Also, but you're right. Working with it and citizen journalism is a big deal now. It has to be. So much of what we know, Justin Ferguson alone, that went on, came more from citizen journalism than, like I mentioned earlier, than I have ever seen. So that it was kind of hard to get around the you know, you couldn't really get around what was being said that really happened, because we had the proof. You know, Dan Johnson, who I know you know, was there, and he did a live stream for 6 days. So if you could stand it, you know, there was a lot of stuff to look at. And, you know, he talked to so many local citizens and learned so much about what they wanted and what they saw. And so citizen journalism did a good job there. There's no question.
Well, and we need to be the media and help get that message out even further. Someone I really like is William Grigg. You know, he writes the Pro Libertate blog, which really some excellent coverage. He's done a lot of great work
Right.
going through the grand jury material. So I think, you know, I should be sending that out to people I know who would be interested on my contact list. I'm also looking to be putting out more content myself about this. I have a tendency to get involved in arguments with folks, and it will distract me from actually writing something to appeal to everyone. But I think we all need to take more responsibility for making sure that these narratives get presented in a thoughtful way. And I think you had mentioned this earlier in the conversation, but that's why I'm getting started with an organization, Spartacus Legal, which is a nonprofit that will be able to provide reliable legal help for people who are in trouble, but also to provide kind of a PR aspect to it, public relations, where we take a boring, complex legal issue and translate it into why should I care about this? Why is it a threat to my liberty? Why is it a threat to the constitutional foundations of our society and my neighbor's safety?
Yeah, and I was happy to mention it earlier. That is excellent, excellent work. And I invite you to anything that you want to post. I invite you to Coffee Party and to Panda and the Solutions Institute, who I'm all involved with. And as you know, we're both involved with Operation Educate, with Derek Grayson, Jason Turner, et cetera. And I will make sure that anything that you write gets put out as often as you want to put it out, certainly. And I look forward to working with you if you'll have me on anything to do with that, because it is a very important area. I have to tell you, I was listening to a radio show the other day. I was invited by a lover of liberty out of Denver, Lisa Brumfell, and on her show they were talking about what's going on with the division of children and family services in various states. And I one of the things that struck me is, from my experience working in law as an undergraduate, is so you just don't know what's going on, as you know. I mean, it's no different than talking about medicine for lay people. You know, we didn't go to law school. We didn't go to medical school. So what do we do? And a lot of people put behind the eight ball after their children get taken. And there's a lot of stuff going on there out there as well as that, especially involving, for example, marijuana, with the marijuana prohibition stuff and medical marijuana things going on because of the complicated laws that they have written around that, speaking of complications, where somebody who gets medical marijuana, they smoke marijuana, but the child gets taken away from them because of having marijuana, for example, another complex area of law. So what you're doing is very important, Catherine. I'm very happy to hear that you did that. It's great. I'm digesting it all. Since you told me a couple hours ago, I've been digesting it. It's great. Fantastic.
Well, we're working on the website now. I'm hoping to launch it next week. It's still just a skeleton up at SpartacusLegal.org, but we will be having, you know, full social media presence. And if anyone wants to sign up to get updates about that, I do have the email sign up. It's actually on my Facebook page right now, which is facebook.com/Catherine, CATHERINE. Four, like the number 4, GA. So Catherine 4GA is the Facebook email address. And there's a link right there at the top if anyone wants to sign up for email updates about Georgia criminal justice reform. We do try not to spam or anything, but I do want to help get the word out about important events that are going on and further updates about our progress on Spartacus Legal.
Fantastic. And I'll make sure that gets out as well. I'll put that in my blog next week and certainly let the Coffee Party and the Panda Universe and Solutions Institute and the universe know about it. And certainly right away, but I can, absolutely. And I guess the next time I didn't see you at the election headquarters, but I guess the next time I'll see you is at Lawrence, if I'm able to go to Lawrence for the David Hooks thing. So I look forward to that, and I want to say thank you so much for coming on to the show. I appreciate it. I appreciate your time, and I appreciate your good works, and I hope everybody that listened in learned something and also appreciates your good works.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Bobby. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to continuing to work with you on these important issues.
Fantastic. You have a great, happy Thanksgiving, great holiday, and I know you have a wonderful family, and you enjoy your Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. You too. And everybody else, remember, you can talk about these issues over Thanksgiving dinner as long as you're nice about it.
Fantastic. We love civility. Take care, Catherine.
All right. Take care, Bobby. Bye-bye.
Catherine Bernard, everybody. I'm so thankful that she was on the show. Glad to have her. Wonderful information. Hard worker for our society. It is a rush to know people who are working for our society, I have to tell you. I've been blessed with knowing so many of them. In Georgia, there's a lot. One of the things that she pointed out is that there is a large number of people here in Georgia that are talking to each other, reaching out to each other from different political ideologies. And I don't know, parties. I hate parties, as you know. But different political ideologies. But they're seeing, we're standing there both looking at the same thing, and we know that we need to talk to each other about, wow, that's wrong. Yeah, that's wrong. What can we do about it? Let's figure it out. And I really like what you said about talking about this. That is important. Family time, it's your family and your friends, and talking about the things that are wrong in a nice, civil way, saying, hey, did you see that? You know, maybe we should pay attention to that. Maybe we need to voice something about it. Write a letter. Make a phone call, whatever it is. Be involved. Absolutely be involved. Engage. Absolutely engage. I want to take care of a little bit of business again. Remember that we have other shows on Coffee Party Radio. On Thursday, we have the wonderful Janine Loudon and Debbie Lipp Molino. Lunch with Loudon, 12 o'clock Pacific time, 3 o'clock Eastern time. Fantastic subjects, well researched, excellent guests. Please join the show. Take a look, take a listen. On Saturdays, the great Egberto Willis, 1 o'clock Eastern time, Politics Done Right. Again, another hardworking individual for our society. Wants to talk to everybody, wants to help our society, spends a lot of time doing it, his own time, and has wonderful guests and always wants to engage with his audience. So feel free to stop by and talk to Egberto. On a final note, I take liberty with my coffee. My name is Bobby Rodrigo, and I'm my family and myself to wish everybody a happy and safe holiday. With nothing but warmth and love and laughter and friends and family. And remember what you have to be thankful for it, and to think of people who aren't as good off or whatever the phrase is I'm looking for, as well off as we are and are less fortunate. And make sure you do something for them as well. And remember, we're in this together, so we're not going anywhere. All of this is happening to all of us. So until next week, this is Bobby Rodrigo signing off. I take liberty with my coffee, everybody, and it damn sure tastes good, I have to tell you. So good night, and happy Thanksgiving.